Right now, on Current State, a new effort to help bring justice to sexual assault victims in Michigan.
This is really empowering to the victim because it allows them to take some measure of control.
Were you targeted by Russian-linked ads during the last election?
And these are likely to have a far greater reach than television ads because they target you where you are, you know, on your phone, on your social media sites that you visit daily.
We'll talk with a Michigan native who says the answer is probably yes. In a week of hard news, follow a college class committing acts of kindness.
I complimented 5 people in 5 minutes, and it was amazing to see the smiles on their faces.
And the surprising places MSU's Sparty shows up.
Coaches come and go. Players absolutely have to come and go. You know, we only get them for a very short amount of time. Sparty is forever.
Current State here on WKAR is next. Welcome to the October 7th and 8th editions of Current State. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick.
It's going to open up opportunities for checks and balances, and that's absolutely what we need for these. These are very, very important kids.
That was State Rep Laura Cox talking about a new effort to make sure all sexual assault evidence kits in Michigan are tested. For years, thousands of kits with physical evidence sat until irreparable damage was done, frustrating victims seeking justice. Our Capitol correspondent, Shayna Roth, a former prosecutor, joins us now. I understand there's a new effort to change this.
These untested rape kits have been in the media spotlight and on people's minds for a few years now. So what happened recently is a House committee decided to amend the budget to set aside a lot of money for the tracking of rape kits. What this does is it will allow for law enforcement, laboratory assistants, and even victims to see where each individual rape kit is going and watch it go through every step of the investigation. And that's kind of one of the things that started this whole problem of having all these untested kits is people just kind of forgot about them. You know, they got put in a drawer, they got put in a box, and they got put in an evidence room, and nobody was keeping track of them. This way, not only will people be able to pull up and say, hey, you know, what's going on with this case? Where's this kit at? It's also going to send out alerts. So if a kit has been, you know, at a lab for too long or it's been in an evidence locker for too long, it's going to send out alerts to the people that need them so that they can say, you know, check in and be like, hey, what's going on with this kit? So the money that they're setting aside is going to go for that software that they've really, from the sounds of the committee hearing and the testimony that they received, the people that they brought in for the software have really designed the software specifically for this need and really to make it as easy and as user-friendly as possible. And then it's also going to go towards training. They're going to get more training on how to use the software and also how to track the kits and to kind of learn more about the importance of these kits.
So how did this problem come to light?
It came to light about 10 years ago in the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. They discovered that there were all of these untested kits. There were several thousand kits just in boxes, still sealed, hadn't even been looked at by any laboratory professionals. And Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy said, this is not okay. We really need to take a stand here. So they gathered these kits and they started in, you know, batches of hundreds of these kits to test them. From there, the Attorney General's office got involved. About 2 years ago, their office did an audit of all of the untested rape kits throughout the state. They found that there were still over 1,000 untested kits throughout the state. And it varied by county, it varied by police department. So the Attorney General's office has also really been trying to make sure that these kits are getting tested. And these kits are really important for a few reasons. One, they contain evidence. You know, these are swabs taken from victims. These kits are really useful, not just for individual cases, but they've been able to find serial rapists and serial offenders. They've, I think, found almost 100 or over 100 serial offenders. By testing all of these kits, by doing these investigations, by getting these convictions, they're really getting some very dangerous people off the street.
As a former prosecutor, how frustrating must this be for victims who are waiting for justice?
This woman that I spoke with, she said, you know, some of these women, they just assumed that nothing was going to happen with their case, that their case was forgotten about, that or that there wasn't any DNA at all. And then, you know, years later, sometimes decades later, they find out that their kit was just lost or their kit was just forgotten. It's very traumatizing for them. It's very discouraging for them. In particular, Prosecutor Worthy's office, they've really been making an effort to make sure that every kit is tested. And now there are laws in this, there are laws in the state that require all kits be tested quickly. One of the best things about it is that victims are allowed to track their kits. And as this advocate that I spoke with explained, this is really empowering to the victim because it allows them to take some measure of control with the process and with what's going on. They don't have to, you know, keep calling or feel like they're bothering people. They can look up on their phone and see, okay, my kit is here, my kit is there. And if they think that it's taking too long or they see that the little alert has gone from green to yellow, they can call the lab, they can call the detective and be like, hey, what is going on with my case? What is going on with my kit? You know, make it go faster. And that's something that before they were just left to wonder what happened, what's going on. And this is really going to give them a sense of power and a sense of taking some control back.
Well, thank you for covering this story, Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Paddock killed 58 people Sunday night before taking his own life. Now it is
Sunday night will mark 1 week since a gunman opened fire in Las Vegas, killing nearly 60 people and injuring more than 500 attendees of a country music concert. A man from Michigan is among the wounded. Lee Dorschacht returned to Warren with a broken leg last week. He says he was greatly aided by an off-duty officer and an off-duty nurse who stabilized his injury. The disturbing images and sounds of the shooting seem to be everywhere, on TV, social media, and even on the radio, and we will not be sharing them in this broadcast. They are difficult for adults, but experts say children have a particularly hard time comprehending what happened. WKAR's Morning Edition host Brooke Allen sought advice from a local counselor for how to soothe your children.
Karen Masol is a licensed professional counselor and registered play therapist with Wellspring Counseling in Lansing, and she specializes in working with children after trauma. Because of this happening in Vegas, and kids in Michigan obviously are seeing this on social media, they're seeing it on the news, they're hearing everybody talk about this.
Yes.
First question I have is, what do parents say to kids?
I think the first thing is what parents do is comfort. And I just think comfort, comfort, comfort. You do this through holding a soothing voice, gentle touches, because what physical comfort does is begins to calm a highly aroused brain. And knowing that children are concrete thinkers means that they don't have words for the horror that they are seeing, hearing, feeling. So along with this holding and comforting children in the most soothing way that you can, I think the next thing that parents can do is give words to these feelings that the children have. Children are feeling scared, they're feeling confused, they're feeling sad. So a parent can just say, you seem very scared, you seem frightened, you seem sad. And then you affirm that and just say, of course you're scary. What you saw was a scary thing. And then I think it can be very helpful for parents to, in a sense, re-identify your relationship, a parent, a child, a teacher, a friend, an aunt, anybody, by saying, because I'm your mommy, daddy, aunt, teacher, it's my job to do all I can to keep you safe and to help you. So you hear in that, we're not promising children that we will forever protect them from danger. We clearly live in a world where bad things happen. But when bad things happen, what we do is move to help. And so we're giving them that message that we will help to repair. So I'm your mommy, daddy, teacher, and it's my job to do all I can to help keep you safe and to help you if anything happens.
As far as ages go, mm-hmm. I have 5-year-old twins, and although to my knowledge, I was certainly not going to talk about this in front of them,
correct.
Not going to show them any video.
Wise.
But somehow they knew it, they heard it somewhere, and had nightmares all night.
Yeah.
And were screaming, you know, and they're 5. So
that's terrifying.
So from 5 years old, how do you address the different ages with something like this that is so out there right now?
Yeah. Especially with the younger children. First of all, what is critical for parents to do is to protect children from, sorry to say this, Brooke, but from the news. I mean, adults certainly need to, and when children develop abstract thinking and they need to begin to develop thought processes about the world, they have the brain capacity to do that. But yet, we never know what the news is going to be. You didn't Saturday know that this was going to be your focus this week. So when we protect children from them, that from screens and from media and even, you know, radio, just be with your children when they're there. Mm-hmm. And as an adult, choose time. Definitely listen to the news, watch the news, hear what's going on. So the first big thing is protect. And there are a lot of children who are not protected from that. So when they get in a setting like school, they're going to process it.
Right.
They're going to talk about it. They're going to work it out. So I think protecting, so when they're little, we can do the things like comfort, give words for the emotion, remind them that we're the adult, and it's our job to do what we can to protect and then to help, and encourage them then to play. Would you like to draw a story? Should we tell a story about this? So that we can take them beyond what has frozen them in the horror.
Okay, so it's really all about finishing the story with them and letting them get beyond that fear.
Which they can do if we first have comforted them.
Okay.
So when we're held in a safe place, then we can begin to go, okay, now I can tell you what's really, really hurting inside. But if we don't feel safe, we're not going to go there.
You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong when I'm on your shoulders. You raise me up to more than I can be. You raise me
It may not feel much like it lately, but there is good in the world, and you don't have to go very far to find it. Lisa Berry from the NPR member station in Ypsilanti visited an Eastern Michigan University professor who is encouraging students to replace bad news with good deeds.
As public relations students,
Professor Lolita Cummings Carson stands before her public relations writing class in the Prey Herald building on the Eastern Michigan University campus and reviews their latest assignment. One of those assignments is conducting random acts of kindness and sharing what happened via social media.
We cannot stop the acts of hate and the messages of hate on kindness. It's just that, you know, darkness cannot survive where there's light. And I think these acts of kindness provide the light that we all need to demonstrate that this campus does not belong to those who hate. It belongs to those who are going to be loved and accepting. And these acts of kindness are a perfect example of that and pushing the hate out.
Professor Cummings Carson, who has been teaching at Eastern for 24 years, says it's her intention to combat evil with good and shine a light where there may be darkness, especially in light of recent racist graffiti incidents in the area.
They're intentionally spreading hate, so we are intentionally combating that with acts of love.
Since she is also teaching a social media class this semester, she is having students use different hashtags and tweet about what they're doing. Hashtags including Campus Kindness, EMU Socialites, and Eagle Kindness, because she says eagles fly higher, and she hopes this effort spreads to campuses around the country. Back in the classroom, senior Autumn Bell talks about performing a random act of kindness on the EMU campus recently by giving someone her parking space.
I did that on a Monday, so on that Wednesday, she was the same person waiting for another parking spot, and she noticed me, and I'm like, you know, you can have it again. And I told them this morning, like, nobody ever, like, waits for me to get a parking spot. So today, somebody waited to give me a parking spot, and I'm like, oh, this act of kindness really comes back, you know, it's really good.
Gabriel Burgess Smith is a second-year grad student at Eastern who baked some acts of kindness for her coworkers.
Sometimes, you know, we just have a day where we're just not feeling it. We're a little bit bogged down with all of the troubles of the world. And I was feeling that way, so what brightens my mood are sweets. So I made cupcakes.
After a classroom discussion of what students have been doing to spread kindness, the class heads outside to see what else can be done around campus. I conduct my own, perhaps not so random act, holding the door open for people as we enter the Student Center on Eastern's campus.
Guys, look at you holding doors.
As we pass a table distributing LGBT information, one of the members of the class, Deb Burke, makes a point of stopping and engaging with the student, handing out the materials.
Well, I know sometimes when you're sitting at tables, people just walk by and ignore you. So I thought, well, I'm curious about what you guys are doing and what kind of great things you're doing for the campus.
Even though she teaches the class, Professor Cummings Carson says she's been finding opportunities herself to be nice to others in hopes of creating a community, taking community back.
I complimented 5 people in 5 minutes, and it was amazing to see the smiles on their faces when you just walk up to someone, and it's actually very genuine, because we see people all the day, and we like their clothes, or we like their smile, or we like their eyes, and then just come up and tell them about it.
As we walk across campus back to the classroom, Professor Cummings Carson says she plans to continue the effort even when she's not teaching the social media class.
I'll continue to have them tweet, and I'll continue to have them use the hashtag Campus Kindness, and I'll continue to work with student government and anyone else I can to have it spread beyond this university, but as far and as wide as we can get it.
You may have heard how Facebook ads specifically targeted Michigan voters during the presidential election last year, in which Republican Donald Trump defeated Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton by 10,000 votes. Last week, several media outlets reported a number of Russian-linked Facebook ads specifically targeted at our state's voters. Joining us now to talk about this is Shannon McGregor, assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Utah. She recently wrote an article for BuzzFeed on this topic, and she has a Michigan tie. She was born in Detroit. She joins us now from Utah via Skype. Hello, Shannon.
Hello.
So how were Michigan voters targeted?
So Michigan voters were targeted via different social media accounts, and specifically through the Facebook ads that you've mentioned have been revealed in term through these different investigations that the government is conducting. And the way that advertisers can use Facebook to target people in particular geographic locations or that have particular interests is through Facebook's ad platform. They're able to target people based on where they live, and they're also able to target them based on what some of their interests are. This is a common use of Facebook advertising platform that these Russian-linked Facebook ads made use of as well.
What did the messages say?
The messages seemed, at least according to the sources that have been reported upon about seeing them, were pretty divisive. They were including promoting things like anti-Muslim messages, tying Hillary Clinton in particular to having Muslim support.
When we think of campaign ads, we think of television, but how influential are Google, Facebook, and Twitter?
Increasingly, campaigns are making use of digital advertising. Companies like Facebook, Twitter, and Google were part of the $1.1 billion of paid digital advertising in the 2016 presidential campaign. And these are likely to have, in some cases, a far greater reach than television ads because they target you where you are, you know, on your phone, on your social media sites that you visit daily.
In your article, you say the staffs helped. In fact, that was kind of the headline, like, forget about the Russian bots, but some of the staffs actually of Facebook helped in this case.
Right, exactly. And so this is why my co-author and I, Daniel Kreese, wanted to write this piece, because while, of course, the interference or potential interference of these Russian ads in the election is, of course, very concerning, but any potential effects of those ads are likely dwarfed by the huge digital effort that the campaigns rolled out. In addition to just the general paid advertising that campaigns put on sites like Facebook and Google and Twitter, those companies also have partisan teams that work directly with the campaigns. And particularly during the general election, the two different campaigns, Hillary Clinton's campaign and Donald Trump's campaign, made different use of these staff that were offered basically from these tech companies. Hillary Clinton's campaign had a large and well-built-out digital effort and didn't make as much use of these digital staffers as did the much smaller Trump campaign. Gary Kobe, who is the director of advertising at the RNC and worked on the Trump campaign as the director of digital advertising and fundraising, had these people from Google, from Twitter, from Facebook occupying their San Antonio digital office during the general election campaign. And we find that these companies offer a lot more consulting and subsidies to these campaigns, advising them not only on the content of ads, but how they might best target voters, how those voters might be persuadable, and what types of information might work best to do that.
What's being done to change this for upcoming elections in 2018 and 2020?
One of the silver linings of the revealing of these Russian-linked ads on Facebook is now that there's increased attention to the transparency or lack thereof in the current state, transparency around digital advertising. TV advertising in terms of campaigns has been regulated by the FEC. Ads have to disclose who has paid for them. Those ads are made public so that journalists, researchers, the public at large can see those ads and who paid for them. Such regulation does not currently exist for digital advertising. There's some new legislation that's being introduced that would work towards making this advertising that appears on our social media feeds transparent, revealing who paid for the ad. Importantly for social media, who was targeted, because it's not like when it's airing on TV and we're all seeing the same ad if we're living in the same market. You and I might see different versions of a same campaign ad. The Trump campaign mentioned using upwards of 40 to 50,000 different iterations of an ad based on who they were trying to target.
Well, we've been talking with Shannon McGregor, assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Utah, talking about the influence of political ads on sites like Facebook and Twitter, and she joined us from Utah via Skype. Thank you, Shannon. It's been really enlightening what you shared.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, Lansing's new medical marijuana ordinance takes effect this weekend. Learn how much material and money you will need to operate these businesses from now on. And Sparty is more than a guy who pops up at football games.
Coaches come and go. Sparty is forever.
The surprising places where the MSU mascot shows up in the next half hour of Current State. But first, in honor of Hispanic Heritage Month, we salute one of the longtime voices here on WKAR, Tony El Chayo Cervantes. Here's his story in his own words.
My name is El Chayo Cervantes, and I am the Ondas en Español radio show director.
¿Qué tal, amigos? Muy buenos días. Directamente desde Communication Arts Building, Michigan State University, East Lansing, Michigan, U.S. of A.
Ondas means waves, like the waves in the river, the waves in the ocean, the waves in the lake. But we're talking radio and we're talking music. So Ondas is musical waves. I was born in a small town in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. I was brought to Michigan back in August of 1960. I went to Beth High School. I was a drummer for a Tejano band back in April of 1968. They wanted to start a radio show, WKR, since then made it possible. So we have a mix of Hispanic music. And in between, either make dedications or the weather or PSAs, either in English or Spanish.
Amigo de la alegría y enemigo de la tristeza.
We're online, so we're all over the place. I had a call from a lady from Saginaw a couple years ago. Her daughter, she was a sergeant in the military, and they were listening to Ondas in Iraq.
Con el Chayo en KR. Bueno, bye.
I've been asked several times, when are you retiring? But I'm here. I still come in, and I thank God for the health and the energy that it gives me to keep doing it. You appreciate it or you don't. But if you listen, that's all I need, your ears.